It's the Veterans Radio Hour. Brought to you by Dallas Corporation for all your corporate printing needs. And by GAM Productions, creating internet solutions. Websites can do that. Now, stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Hour is next on the Veterans Radio Network.
Tango Charlie Bravo, you're a go for the Veterans Hour.
Websites can do that. What does GIM Productions have that makes them think that they can make a website do what I want? Data-driven.
Creative design.
Interactive menus.
Sound and multimedia.
How about making my website actually work for me? I want an internet application that not only gathers information, but processes the information to something useful. Maybe even link our existing application into a website.
GIM Productions internet applications offer limitless possibilities. Each application is designed uniquely for your purpose. We make applications work for you.
They're more than just a pretty face. Websites can do that.
GIM Productions, helping you make money.
Welcome, one and all, to the Veterans Radio Hour. It's our tribute to all of those who served our great nation's armed forces, past and present, and their tremendous accounts of heroic duty and bravery. With your host, Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, coming to you live from our Veterans Center studio, here is General Dave.
And good evening. Welcome to Veterans Radio Hour. It's good to be back with this group of people that are dedicated to America's veterans, that are veterans and care about the United States of America and service to the nation. The show tonight's about the United States Air Force's Thunderbirds, and the mission of the Thunderbirds is to help recruit and retain soldiers in the United States Air Force, as well as reinforcing public confidence in our military by demonstrating professionalism and competence. As many of you may know, that each service has a team. The Air Force has the Thunderbirds, the Army has the Golden Knights parachuting team, the Navy has the Blue Angels, and the Marine Corps has the Marine Band. Tonight we have four great guests on the line with us. We have Lieutenant Colonel Richard McSpadden, he's the Thunderbird commander. We have Captain Chris Callahan. We have Crew Chief Staff Sergeant Scott Harris, and we have Crew Chief Linda Mayfield. So some great guests tonight for our show. So Kenny, to you.
Thank you, General Dave. Here we are. We're glad you're with us. Don't forget, 866-928-2329. If you'd like to call in, you can also go on our website, veteransradiohour.com, and type right into our chat room. General Dave?
Okay. Tonight, the show is going to be dedicated to those that support the deployment to the Middle East, specifically in the Persian Gulf. And I want to just go over a note that came from a Jeff Cole. Jeff Cole's retired Marine, and he's working at Camp Doha offloading equipment for possible war for Iraq. And he says that they're working around the clock, 12-hour shifts, cycling units up to the Kuwaiti border with Iraq. The units fly in with great regularity, are bused to Camp Doha and other camps, and then they issue them their vehicles. In a matter of hours, they're off to the desert encampments. He's on a night shift. He works from 7 p.m. at night, Kenny, to 7 a.m. the next morning. And during the last 4 days, they have cycled through much of the 3rd Infantry Divisions, the Rock of the Marne, out of Fort Stewart, Georgia. They're under lights. They work hard at night. They make things happen. They get people ready for combat. He usually unloads recently the main battle tank of the United States Army, the 70-ton Abrams. And all these young troopers are ready to go. He misses being in their boots, wishes them well, and they say, if it's time for war, let's roll.
Here is today's military quote of the day, brought to you by support from retired Lieutenant Commander Adrian Rubenkowski.
Some of you have heard this quote maybe before, but it's worth reading again, especially with all the anti-war protest, which we defend the right for those to do that, and I'm proud to have done that the last 30 years of my service. Someone came up the other day and approached Secretary of State Colin Powell. And it was an Iraqi journalist. And he said, isn't it true, Secretary Powell, that only 13% of the young Americans can even locate Iraq on a map? Secretary Powell stopped and turned and then stated, yes, sir, you are correct. But unfortunately for you, all 13% are United States Marines.
You're listening to the Veterans Hour with retired Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, back to the broadcast.
I'm sure you know some of those Marines, too.
You betcha. We may even have a couple lurking around here tonight. Anyway, to talk about this Thunderbird unit, this is wonderful, and we're going to let the experts talk about it in a minute, but I just want to give you a couple of facts on them. The squadron was officially activated in 1953. It's headquartered in Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. I've been there, a great post. It's by Las Vegas, you know that.
Yes, you've been there a few times.
No, not there, just Nellis. Anyway, there's 8 pilots involved, 4 support officers, 3 civilians, and 130 enlisted. That's a lot of enlisted. I'm sure they're going to explain they get that much support. I never had that much support for any operation in the Army. But then they're doing some high-speed stuff, and it's very critical. Everything is in seconds of time. Things have to be perfect. There's no screwing around with maintenance. And so just all kidding aside, this is very demanding work and requires that kind of a team. The largest crowd that ever watched the Thunderbirds was in Coney Island, New York, July 4th, 1887, at 2.5 million people, Kenny. So great turnout. They do about 88 air demonstrations a year. They've performed for more than 280 million people in all 50 states and in 57 different countries, totaling 3,800 aerial shows. So right now on the line, I'm going to go to the commander first, and Lieutenant Colonel Richard McSpadden, Jr. It's his second season as a commander. He's the leader of the Thunderbirds. He flies number one jet, leading all demonstrations, as commanders should do, lead the way. And he commands this 120-person squadron. So, Richard, are you with us, sir?
I am. Good evening, General Grange.
Yeah, thanks for joining us tonight at Veterans Radio Center.
Thank you for having us. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, thank you. It's our honor to be on a line with you. And as a commander, let me just turn it over to you, and why don't you just give us a quick rundown on your unit?
Well, you hit the highlights of it. It's 120 people strong. We span some 25 different career fields. And our mission is to recruit the next generation of airmen that are going to come along and join the ranks of the Air Force and continue to make it the world's most dominant and the world's most respected air and space force.
Well, you got that. I'm sure that everybody knows that. I know it, and myself from experience with support from the Air Force when I was a soldier and my support to the Air Force. But there's no doubt that's the number one force in the world. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. And of course, another part of our mission is we just like to travel the globe, literally, and show people the capabilities of the United States Air Force and show them the kind of people that are involved in the Air Force and the pride and professionalism that is throughout our Air Force.
You know, when the Panama invasion went down, General Downing, commander of all the special op units at the time, was getting ready to hit a compound. They're going to have the Rangers hit a compound in Panama, and the they were deciding, well, how are we going to do this hit or not? Well, maybe we can talk these guys out of it. So they went ahead and talked to the commander, Panamanian commander of the one of Noriega's units of the compound, and said, look, we want to show you a little demonstration. And they went ahead and did a demonstration on how they would take down their compound, the objective. And after the demonstration, they just surrendered. And I would ask you if you could volunteer to do that in Baghdad for us. it may just have them capitulate early, because I think the awe of your organization would just have them just fall to their knees and weep.
Well, I could shorten the process. You're right. If logical heads prevailed, but from what we've seen over in Iraq, there aren't logical heads that are running that place. So,
Roger that. Okay, Commander, we're just going to go to Linda Mayfield just for a second, because she's
great.
On the line with us, and say hello to Linda. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, how are you?
We're fine here. Could you explain what the veteran crew chief does in the organization?
Well, I was the assistant dedicated crew chief on Thunderbird number 2 in 89 and Thunderbird number 3 in 91. And we work hard getting the aircraft ready for the air shows and maintaining them.
Uh-oh.
I think you took us seriously on this demonstration. Anyway, what were the two type of aircraft that you, or more, that you handled as the veteran crew chief?
With the Thunderbirds, it was the F-16 A and B model.
A and B. Okay, they have what now, the C?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so you've been doing this for how long again?
I'm retired from the Air Force.
Right.
So I did 20 years, and I retired. And now I work at Eglin Air Force Base as a contractor, as a aircraft electrical and environmental systems technician.
There you go. So you got to keep people of experience to help the United States military, because it's not a big organization, as many people think. We need people all over the place to make this thing go. By the way, I went to high school down there.
Oh, it's a nice area.
Fort Walton. No, it was. I lived at Fort Walton, but it was at Choctahatchee High School. Isn't that right by Eglin, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, so could you, what's the last, go back to the commander here, go back to Richard. What's the last demonstration you guys pulled off?
Let's see, the last official demonstration we flew was at Lake City, Florida this year in November of 2002. And that pretty much tracks our season. We go out on the road and fly demonstrations from mid-March to mid-November. And then from mid-November to mid-March, we're training and getting ready for the next year's season.
And all that training's done at Nellis?
It is all done at Nellis, just up the road at a place called Indian Springs, about 35 miles north of Nellis.
Yeah, I did some night stuff there.
Did you?
Yeah, some night, different kind of airplanes. They had propellers, but night ops around Indian Springs.
Yeah, great great training location for a bunch of different missions.
Yeah, it sure is. It very much is. Now, what about good and bad experiences of the organization? Since you've been in command, why don't you just tell me one of the highlights, the greatest experience so far in command?
Well, it's tough to put my finger on any one event, because they're all so positive and so enjoyable. I would say they all probably revolve around the fact that we get to go out and represent the world's most dynamic Air Force. And I've often said if Americans could, they would stand on the flight line and cheer the operational units that are launching sorties into Afghanistan and protection sorties over Iraq, because those are the operational people in the Air Force. They're really doing the mission of the Air Force. But they can't, so by extension, they come out and they cheer us. And to be able to stand there in front of literally hundreds of thousands of people and to receive the kind of confidence and adulation that Americans have for their Air Force is really quite rewarding. And that's probably the best experience that we get over and over again.
You know, that's a good point, because people cannot go where the combat operations are occurring or the actual operations, but they can watch and see and talk to the professionalism and the Air Force units are by just being with your unit on the ground at these different sites.
Yes, sir, and that is in fact the case, and so that's very enjoyable for us, and it comes at we realize that there's some pressure involved there. You know, when you're trying to represent a force that is so well regarded by Americans, that is so close to perfection in and of themselves, that we need to live up to that challenge week in and week out. So we work hard to do that.
Yeah, live the standard. Roger that. Now, I understand we have Captain Chris Callahan with us, a right wing. Are you with us, Captain?
I am, sir. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for including us tonight.
Hey, my pleasure. How long have you been with the outfit?
I've been with the Thunderbirds as long as Colonel McSpadden has. We came on the team together, and we'll do our 2 years together.
Yeah, and you came from what other organization?
I was an instructor pilot in T-38s in Texas, and prior to that, I'd flown the F-15, the air-to-air version, for 3 years.
Uh-huh. So explain to the audience F-15 air version, what you just said.
The F-15 is really the world's greatest air superiority fighter. It is a... It is an asset that's unmatched right now, and it takes great combat power and capability to the battlefield, and truly where the Air Force makes its money. And any other operations that the Air Force or anyone else does is first to take control of the high ground, to dominate the airspace above any battlefield or any theater that we'll do. And by having the F-15 out there to be able to do that, we can achieve that first priority very well.
Now, why does, and I'll ask either one of you, Richard or Chris, why Why is it that the Thunderbirds use the F-16 then?
Well, the F-16 is a multi-role fighter that does a number of air-to-air missions very well, air-to-air, air-to-ground. It does night attack very well. Very versatile fighter. And for us, it works very well because it's smaller, it's single engine, so it's less expensive to operate. And because of its multi-role capability, a lot of people can identify with it. So it's more closely identified with the Air Force. It's used in some 19 countries around the world. A superb, superb fighter.
Yeah. Well, I've used it at night. I've used it for real, and I've used it on practice live fires. Good airplane, great night capability. I'm just curious about why you used it as in the Thunderbirds, and you explain that to the audience and myself. I think we have also with us tonight Crew Chief Staff Sergeant Scott Harris. Are you with us?
Yes, sir. Good evening.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure. How long have you been with the Thunderbirds?
I'm entering my fourth season.
Fourth season?
Yes, sir.
And so this is your second or third captain or lieutenant pilot you've been working with.
Well, actually, sir, my first 3 years on the team, I worked with the night shift maintenance crew, whereas we were responsible for most of the maintenance that's done on the airplanes. This last year, I was fortunately picked up for the show line, where we're actually in front of the crowds doing the shows. And Captain Callahan, I was lucky enough to be assigned to the number three airplane as his crew chief.
Aha. Uh-huh. Hear that, Captain?
Well, I'm lucky enough to have.
That's right, because you can't do anything without Harris.
That's bottom line. Harris or any other of the great maintainers that we have, they're the backbone of our organization.
Roger that. Now, listen, I'd like to go to the commander here. And I want to get to the first question that came in. I want to yeah. Grab it while the people are still there with us.
Okay.
It says here, when were the Thunderbirds first organized and what planes did they fly?
In 1953, we were originally at Luke Air Force Base, Nevada, and we flew the Luke Air Force Base, Arizona, and we flew the F-84G.
Uh-huh. And what about, is there any pilots that come to mind that started the thing that stand out in the history of the Thunderbirds?
Oh, yes, sir. There's a handful of them that started it. And just let me add, General, in case the listeners haven't done the math real quick, this is our 50th show season, our 50th anniversary, so we're real proud of that.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that.
Thank you. But the first commander leader was a gentleman by the name of Dick Catledge, and I still talk to him and email him frequently. I've seen him at a couple show sites last year.
So he's like a mentor still of the organization.
He is very, very much interested in how we're doing and how we do business and the changes that evolved. It's always interesting to talk to him. And, of course, I asked him, did he ever envision, you know, that it would get this big? And he said they did. They knew when they first started that they were onto something pretty big.
Let me ask a question to Captain Callahan on the Captain Callahan, that would be the best guy to ask this, I guess. What is the major difference between the Thunderbird program and the Blue Angels program? That's from one of our callers.
I think we both the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds are really more similar than we are different. The shows are a little bit different. Certainly we fly different aircraft, so we'll demonstrate the different capabilities, we with the F-16 and the Blue Angels with the F-18, so... it's a little bit different, but we get together on an annual basis with those folks, and it really is a great time, great chance for us to meet and talk with each other, talk about how we do business, and we come away with that finding out that we're certainly very much more alike than we are different at all.
Yeah, I've seen both outfits, and they're both wonderful, and makes you proud to be an American citizen to see the professionalism of both the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels. Linda, in your active service days as crew chief, what was the biggest challenge in that position in service to the Thunderbirds?
Making sure the aircraft were safe to fly on time so that we didn't have any delays due to maintenance. That's one of the proud things for the maintenance people is that air show has never been canceled due to maintenance problems.
Never?
Never.
That's amazing. How many backup aircraft do you have?
They take two on the road, at least they did when I was on the team. I'm sure they still do the same now.
Now, let's say that you're moving from Nellis to Coney Island, New York. How do you move everything there?
Well, the pilots fly the aircraft, and the maintenance and support personnel fly on a C-141.
Now, is that C-141 dedicated to the team all the time?
No. They change with every trip.
Okay, so you obviously have a priority code to get these airplanes.
Correct, and it also helps those people in the Air Force and those other areas that maybe not fighter-related, but the moving people around in the cargo, they get to see and feel what it's like to be a part of the show.
Yeah. Let me go back to the commander a second. And do you have, when you talk about some of the old-timers that used to be with the outfit, do you have, like, dining-ins, dining-outs, you know, some get-togethers annually or something like that of Thunderbirds?
We do. Every year we have what finishes our season is a reunion show. In some cases we call it a Fitzgerald show, named after one of the former commander leaders.
Right.
But at that show it's dedicated, it's a private audience. It's only our family and former team members. And so they're all invited out to Nellis Air Force Base here in Las Vegas, and we perform for them and then have a banquet and so forth.
So you do it right at Nellis?
We sure do.
And I guess the majority of the people attending are veterans of the unit.
Oh, yes, sir. They are.
Yeah.
In fact, it just varies. This year we're having a big reunion, as you would expect, for our 50th anniversary, and I know the attendance of that is already over 1,000.
So oh, I'm sure. It's got to be.
It's going to be a great great event for us.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's also kind of a fun show for us, because it's one thing to perform in front of a bunch of people, but it's another thing to perform in front of just a handful of alumni who know the business very well.
It's sort of like taking the oral exams.
It sure is.
Yeah.
So I've often said you could put us in front of several hundred thousand people, but put one alumni in the audience and things notch up a bit.
Yeah, they're watching close. Okay, we're going to have to move out of the first phase of our show tonight, and we're going to turn it over to Kenny. We'll be right back to you guys. Go ahead.
Thank you, General Dave. This is our 24th program, and we're talking about those Thunderbirds. We also want to mention military.com, saluting all who answer the call to our nation's service. I'd like you also to maybe make you aware tonight of the 1350 Foundation, dedicated to America, the American flag, and encouraging active and purposeful citizenship. One sad note to bring up today, and I think it's appropriate. Our mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, a reserved Marine veteran, unfortunately, tonight his mother died, Sis Daley, 96 years old, shortly after 5 today. We give our condolences and our best wishes to Sis Daley and the Daley family. Remember the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund at vvmf.org and see the night vision that's now being offered as a limited edition. We also want to let you know the next week's program, we will be remembering the Kabatatuan Camp. That's the death march in the Philippines, the Bataan Death March. We're going to be talking about Philippine-American soldiers, those both in the Philippines, those in the Americans, and those that were Philippine-American. It's going to be quite a unique show dealing a little bit more with World War II and where we stand today with these veterans. We'll be back right after these messages, the Veterans Radio Hour.
You're listening to the Veterans Hour on the Talk Radio Network.
You're listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. We're here every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time on the Talk Radio Network and also on the Internet. It's a one-hour program. However, we do continue after the broadcast portion goes off on the Talk Radio Network. We continue with streaming on the Internet to answer any additional questions and to tie up loose ends. So stay with us, and you'll be able to get something a little extra here on the Internet. The Veterans Radio Hour comes to you every week at this time, every Sunday night. We broadcast live from the Veterans Center Studios here in Downers Grove, Illinois. If you're in the area and you'd like to be in our studio audience, we invite you to come by. You can come in around 8:30. The program begins at just at about 9 o'clock, and you'll receive a warm welcome, and it's a very friendly, informal atmosphere here. I wanted to mention some of the people who are behind the scenes at the Veterans Radio Hour and helped to make the program possible. Carl King, the engineer and production director.
Lambert Matias, the studio manager, Mark Eli, webmaster and chatmaster, Kenny DeCamp, of course, who you hear on the air, a senior producer working closely with General Dave Grange each week to make the show a reality. Joe Saguski is the phone moderator. I'm Fred Cutchins, the internet announcer, and let me also mention that the Veterans Radio Hour was created by Lance Hack, inspired by his dad, Ralph Hack, who served in the China-Burma-India Theater, CBI Theater, during World War II. We're also going to be graced this evening again with a musical a vocal selection by Mark DeMinn, who has been appearing and entertaining us for the last few weeks, and we're glad to have him back here again tonight. Let me give you a website to check out, the 1350 Foundation, which is a very interesting organization, nonprofit, nonpartisan, whose purpose is to instill knowledge about the United States flag, to encourage thought and discourse about what it means to be an American, to promote active citizenship and humanitarianism, and to recognize individuals who have represented the United States flag and the nation well. The website is www.1350foundation, that's all one word, .org, www.1350foundation.org. They're going to have a great event here on March 4th entitled A More Perfect Union, The Rights and Responsibilities of Citizenship. Several fascinating guests and people will be appearing at that event, including Dale Sprosty, who is a U.S. Army veteran, who over a 54-year period has played taps at more than 5,000 memorial services. If you'd like to be in attendance, why don't you log on to the website, or you can actually call the director, Carla Norowski, at 773-477-4036. We'll be coming back on the air very shortly here at the Veterans Radio Hour. Stay with us, and it's good to know you're all out there. Thank you. We'll be back shortly.
The Veterans Hour now returns to full readiness on the TRN Talk Radio Network. The Veterans Hour proudly presents our military hero's story of valor.
Tonight's hero is Lieutenant Colonel Roy Lothner. He wrote, he is the author of I Am the Infantry. And where, what special, it's a special, I'd say a special poem. It's a production shown to many troops, but it's where brave men fight there fight I in freedom's cause I live and die. It's a very motivating poem that all infantrymen hear, and many that have been at Fort Benning have heard this before. He penned this epic poem, I Am the Infantry, nearly 40 years ago, and it was following a 20-year career that took him from the beaches of Normandy to Korea to Iran and back again to the place he called home, which happens to be the home of the infantry, Fort Benning, Georgia. It was here that the entertainment director for Special Services, Roy Lothner, authored and produced this live theatrical presentation, I Am the Infantry. And it goes from, the narrative goes from the infantry's birth and evolution over 200 years of service to the nation. More than 5 million soldiers have heard this tale, and it continues to be shown and read at graduations and ceremonies in Marshall Auditorium at Fort Benning, on parade fields, worldwide, and in infantry units everywhere. John Wayne even once tried his hand at recording it. And today, very few know anything about the author. And Lieutenant Colonel Roy Lothner, the author of I Am the Infantry, died this last January, and he's buried at Fort Benning, Georgia, at the Main Post Cemetery.
The Veterans Radio Hour salutes the active service person of the week, made possible through the support of Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. As they say, PBR me, ASAP. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, available at your local retail outlet.
Okay, tonight we're going to recognize two of our active service personnel. It's from, they're from the 933rd Military Police Company. They're just activated on February 7th and deployed overseas. Two of them, the commander of the unit, Captain Todd Pentecost, and the First Sergeant Daryl Richburg. Now, this unit has experience and legacy going back to World War I and World War II, both in the Pacific and the European campaigns. The 933rd was mobilized and placed on active federal service in 91, also in 97 on different operations, both Desert Storm and again an operation Joint Guardian in Germany. And so in the last 12 years, this is their third activation. Good luck to the 933rd.
You're tuned to the Veterans Radio Hour with retired General Dave Grange, coming to you from the Veterans Center Studio. And now, back to the show.
Okay, so we're heading back to our great guest tonight from the Thunderbird Unit, the United States Air Force's demonstration team. We got with us Lieutenant Colonel Richard McSpadden. He's the commander. We have former Crew Chief Linda Mayfield. We have the right wing pilot, Captain Chris Callahan, and we have an active crew chief, Staff Sergeant Scott Harris. And they're all with us tonight on telephone at the Veterans Radio Center. And I think we'll go back this time. We'll go right back to the commander, Richard McSpadden. And, Richard, I'd like to ask you a question. During wartime, let's say we really get going here in a war, do the Thunderbirds still perform?
We sure do. We will still go on the road. We'll continue to do our mission. So we expect to be out there and still do what we do and show people the capability of the Air Force here at home and help support our troops abroad doing the mission by just generating some homeland support for them and building public trust and confidence in the Air Force.
Well, speaking of that, and this comes from Jeff Circle as a question. How much do the Thunderbird shows impact on service recruiting? And let me add to that, has it had a stronger impact in the last year?
Let me just understand your question. The first part of it is how much do we impact service recruiting?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes, yes, that's it.
Substantially so. And in fact, we have found that we continually poll our recruits as they come into the Air Force, and we ask them, you know, what is the recruiting tool that the Air Force has that had the most effect on you deciding to join the Air Force. And the Thunderbirds always rank at the top of that list. So if the recruits see us, we know we have a big impact on them joining the Air Force. And what we found out is we just need to try to find ways to be seen more because not all of them get to see us.
Yeah. Well, that's powerful. And that's, you know, a session of people into the military, you know, recruiting. You can't do anything with any organization unless you can get people, good people. So it's critical to that mission. And this last year, the other part of Jeff's question was, has it picked up this last year?
Air Force recruiting and retention in general has picked up since September 11th. And what we found is, you know, anytime something happens that threatens the national defense or threatens our national security, people want to serve their country. They begin to see that importance of their mission, and they understand the importance day-to-day of what they're doing and the significance of it, and that has a very positive impact on both recruiting and retention.
Yeah. Okay, let me move to Captain Chris Callahan. What's the most difficult maneuver as a pilot you're asked to perform?
Well, sir, you're going to get a different answer for any pilot on the team has a his own personal most difficult maneuver because each flying position is so dynamic and so very different from any of the others. Even though oftentimes we're all in the same formation, there's a completely different set of skills that are required for some maneuvers versus others, and some are just quite difficult, and others are kind of easy. Sometimes they all look easy, and sometimes they all look hard, but I think each guy has his own favorite or most difficult maneuver, and I think when you get the difficult maneuvers right, those are the ones that become your favorite. The climax maneuver that we have at the end of the show is called our bomber's maneuver, and what that entails is the diamond formation pulling up into the vertical and splitting into four different cardinal directions on the compass. The lead solo goes up through the middle of our smoke and does vertical rolls through that, so that gives you that bomber's effect. And we go through a sequence to where we'll basically do a split S or the backside of a loop out of that climb, and we all try to meet at the point that we split up from at the same time. It's very dynamic. It's very difficult to get right. So when we get it right, we're certainly very pleased with that. just because it's so challenging. So that, for me, is the most challenging, and it's also my favorite.
So that is your favorite?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Let me turn to Linda. Linda has served, obviously, for a while. She's a veteran crew chief. She's now at Eglin Air Force Base, still working for the military, I understand. What would you say, Linda, after separating from the military, from the Thunderbirds, what did that do for your job? How did that help your job right now?
Well, everybody knows that the Thunderbirds are very professional, and attention to detail is key. So they know that if you serve with the Thunderbirds, that you have those traits. And they do put you at the top of the list when you go in for an interview.
Well, that is good. But I guess the professionalism, you just take that along, and you're obviously, where you are now, you're a standard setter because of your service with the Thunderbirds, I'd imagine.
Well, right. And all the Thunderbirds are professional. All the people in the Air Force, for that matter, are professionals. You're a professional before you go to the Thunderbirds. That's how you get there. And you're just setting a standard for all to follow. And it's a good feeling. And once you leave there, you continue on with your career, and it doesn't change. You just don't do air shows anymore. And I wanted to piggyback on Colonel McSpadden. I was on the team during Desert Storm, and we traveled. The only changes we had to make is we flew in C-130s instead of 141s.
Because of strategic airlift, yeah.
Yes, they were all deployed.
Yeah.
And with the crowds, and the people were very proud to see anyone in uniform, and thank you for everything that you do. And it was more for the country, and it really helped.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it will happen again this time.
Yeah, I'm sure it will, and well said. That's a great example of what we're talking about here. I want to go to Scott Harris, and, in your experience, was there any incident I don't want to really focus on accidents, but was there any incident or something with maybe budget decisions that, stuff rolls downhill, obviously, came down to affect your performance the potential that the organization could have reached, but you had some constraints put on you during your career?
Honestly, sir, I have to say no. I mean, obviously, I'm not a budget expert. But within my career in the Air Force, which has been now 8 years, some way, somehow, we've always made it happen. No matter what the part was or what the tasking was, we've made it happen. And especially with the Thunderbirds, that's one of the things I'm most proud of. There's been many nights where we're stuck in a real small town with kind of difficulty getting parts out there, and we've always made it happen.
Yeah.
So there's really, I don't say no to that.
Well, how about safety, though? How about safety NOTAMs that were posted because of accidents within the military that affected did it cause any constraints on what you could do or not do?
Again, sir, no. Whenever there's a safety issue that comes down, we will do everything in our power to make that inspection happen, make that change of part happen, do whatever it takes to make sure that we have 6 100% safe airplanes to go up and perform a demonstration or a practice show or whatever their pilots plan on doing that day.
Yeah, that's super. I'm glad to hear it. That's wonderful. We have about 3 minutes left in this segment. There's a couple questions here from that came in. I'd like to bring up to any of you. How much does the F-16D cost?
Well, we fly the F-16CD. The only difference is the D is a two-seat model. And it runs right at 23 to 25 million per airplane.
Yeah. And everybody's, I hear people in the audience here in the table here sucking in their breath. But, airplanes cost a lot. In fact, one of the wings off of one of these planes would probably buy boots for the rest of the Army. I mean, just to put it in perspective. But anyway, let's go to another question here. It has to do with what is the maximum G's the pilots pull during a maneuver?
General, the F-16 can pull just over 9 times the force of gravity, and our solos will take the airplanes right up to that G load, demonstrating the max performance capabilities of the F-16.
Yeah, this is Chris, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and also explain the difference between positive and negative G's.
Simply put, positive G is when you're putting the airplane in a hard turn, going fast in one direction and then changing that direction. It's just kind of physics class. You increase the amount of G on you, so it's You multiply, if you're in a 5G turn, you multiply your body weight and everything on you times 5, and that's about what it weighs, and that's about what it feels like. I'm a pretty tall guy. I'm over 200 pounds, so when I go into a really hard turn, I'm up around 1,800 pounds in my body weight. And negative Gs happen when you go the opposite direction, when you unload the airplane or push forward on the stick. It's that sensation of blood rushing to your head and coming out of your seat.
Yeah, I guess. I haven't had those kind of Gs before. I mean, I've gone pretty fast in flight, but that was before I pulled my parachute. But anyway, you know, in Halo operations. But anyway, okay, so how about, here's another question. Do pilots ever black out or get tunnel vision in the Thunderbirds?
Sir, this is Richard McSpadden here. No, we don't. We wear G suits, and the pilots are very physically fit. We keep on a physical regimen to keep ourselves in top shape, and we don't even ever come close to that.
Yeah. Let me ask a last question from the audience here. What? Let me ask the crew chief this. How long does it take to convert a Thunderbird back to active service?
You're listening to the Veterans Hour on the
Talk
Radio Network.
You're listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. We're here every Sunday evening. The show begins at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time. We're heard on the Internet in some 57 countries, as well as on the Talk Radio Network, where we're heard on some 78 or so stations around the country. We're happy to have everyone listening this evening throughout the country and around the world. Tonight's program is dedicated to the Thunderbirds. The Thunderbirds being a special group of the United States Air Force. The mission of the Thunderbirds is to help recruit and retain soldiers in the United States Air Force, as well as to reinforce public confidence in our military by demonstrating professionalism and competence. We have four very excellent and interesting guests, including Lieutenant Colonel Richard McSpadden, who is the commander leader of the Thunderbirds, which incidentally is celebrating its 50th show season this year. So congratulations to you, Thunderbirds. Also, Captain Chris Callahan, a right wing in the Diamond Formation, Staff Sergeant Scott Harris, crew chief for Captain Callahan, and also Linda Mayfield, who is now retired, works at Eglin Air Force Base. She was formerly crew chief aircraft number 2. This evening's program brings back to mind a program we had recently in which Colonel Bud Day, the most highly decorated flyer in American history, was featured. And I think this is a wonderful example of the kind of programming that we have here and the type of extraordinary guests and information that is imparted to our listeners each week. If you have a comment or if you have a question, if you have an idea for a future show, please feel free to contact us here at the Veterans Radio Hour. You can do so right on our discussion board, or you can call in at 866-928-2329. That's 866-928-2329. Thank you, and we'll be back on the air shortly.
The Veterans Hour now returns to duty on the Talk Radio Network.
Okay, welcome back to Veterans Radio Hour. With us tonight at the Thunderbird team, we got the Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Richard McSpadden. We have Captain Chris Callahan. We have Crew Chief Staff Sergeant Scott Harris. And we have former Crew Chief Linda Mayfield. And we got cut off on the last question there, and I apologize, but I want the listener to get the answer. And that was, how long does it take to convert, if you have to, a Thunderbird aircraft back into combat status?
Well, sir, we're actually authorized 72 hours to convert one of our airplanes back to fully combat-capable status. Back in 1988, we were tasked with that, just to see if we could do it, and we did it in 28 hours all that, but we didn't take the paint off.
Yeah, well done. Here's another question. What is the age of the oldest pilot to ever fly with your group?
Wow.
This is a history question. Anybody that wants to volunteer for that.
You may have actually stumped us on this one.
Well, give us a feel.
I probably, it's got to be, I'm 42 as the acting commander now, so it's probably very close to that. I would say that's probably real close to it. It can't be much older than that.
Yeah. Okay, so a young pilot's business, I guess. Okay, here's another one, and a last question. I'm going to ask for some comments from you after this. The Thunderbirds are going to be in Peoria, Illinois, in June. Are they in any other Illinois air show in 2003? I don't know if you have your schedule right there, but a lot of the people here obviously are in, from Illinois, and they're curious.
Let's see. We're in Chicago the 16th and 17th of August.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that pretty much...
So, Chicago in August and Peoria in June.
As of July 4th, we're in Battle Creek, Michigan, which, of course, is relatively close.
Okay. All right, good. We only have a couple minutes left, and what I'd like to do is, from the four of you, is just get some closing comments on something you just want to pass on to the American people, reference your service in the Thunderbirds or your service to the United States military. And I'll start off with Linda Mayfield.
Well, I just want to thank you for letting me be on the show tonight, and I want to wish the current team members good luck in the upcoming show season, and I hope to see them at reunion. And I just hope that the American people all understand what we have to do for our national security and to remain the people that we are.
Okay, great. Thank you for those nice words. And how about Staff Sergeant Scott Harris? Share some thoughts with us, please.
Well, General, first I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's really a great honor to get a chance to come out and actually talk about what I do on a day-to-day basis and what it really feels like to represent not only the Air Force and the Thunderbirds, but the United States of America and everything that we do. I just want to say thank you very much for that, and it's been a great honor, sir. Thank you.
Well, again, from Veterans Radio Center here, thank you for what you do in service to the United States of America. Captain Chris Callahan, your comments, sir.
General, as well, I want to thank you for your hospitality, hosting us tonight, letting us be on the program, and something we do when we go out to cities all across the country. On Friday mornings, the pilots will go out and fan out to hospitals and high schools. And as part of that recruiting effort, I get to talk to high schoolers about what it is they're going to do with their lives. And the message I always take with me is that I absolutely love my job. Every day that I get to come to work is just, it's an adventure. There's nothing else I'd rather be doing. And I think that's probably my strongest message for folks that are out there listening, and certainly in times like these that we're living in right now, the Air Force and the Armed Forces is a great place to make a difference and to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. And it's very much an honor to do that, and it's an honor to represent all the people that do that as a member of this team.
Yeah, well, that's great. And I didn't know you went out to the high schools like that on these trips, and I think that's really special, and the country appreciates that, I'm sure.
Yes, sir, thanks.
And the commander, Richard, if you could wrap it up, sir.
Yes, sir. I'd just like to say I know your radio audience has a lot of veterans out there, and I'd just like to say to them, to thank them for the service that they put to the country and for the freedoms that they gave us. But also, even more than that, as an active duty service member, you know, we inherit the legacy that they gave us, really. And it's really veterans like yourselves and the people that came before us who taught us how to be determined, how to be tough. The Americans have always been able to count on their military. They have great confidence in us. As the recent poll shows, I don't know if you know it, but about 6 months ago, a poll came out asking Americans which profession do they have the most confidence in the U.S., and the U.S. military ranked number one, ahead of law, medicine, education, ahead of the president, ahead of the Supreme Court. And that's so because of the veterans. And we're just proud to walk into their shoes and pick up the torch where they left off.
Well, Roger that, and great words. And I like the way that both Captain Callahan and Colonel McSpadden just breached the gap between legacy, current service, and the youth of the United States of America. And I want to thank all of you for being on with us tonight. You fired us up. Hooah. And I'm going to turn it over to Kenny now, and we got a special treat for you.
We always, at this time, are going to switch over from the radio airwaves directly onto just our website. So stick with us. We'll be doing that. And to do that, once again, our singer, Mark Demin, the vocalist that we have. This goes out to the Thunderbirds. Mark, take it away.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. My heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
You've been listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. Join us next week again for another great show from the Veterans Center Studios. Good night.
Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true.
That's it. We do. We love the Thunderbirds as well, and he flew us to the moon. We are back here on VeteransRadioHour.com. We're going to continue for a few more minutes. I want to thank Mark Eli right off the bat for helping put this all together. He's our webmaster, and I guess, Mark, you did some work with the Thunderbirds?
No, I didn't. I actually served.
You've just been in love with them.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I knew you were in the Air Force, though. General Dave, we'll go back for a little while and talk. We still have all of our guests online with us.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, some of the people in the audience were talking about this, and it's so very true, that a lot of our shuttle people, astronauts, those in the space program, come from the flying community for many services, Air Force, Navy, Army, Marine. And with the loss of the shuttle the other day, both American flyers, as well as from Israel, it kind of brings it home to us about the dedication and the sacrifice that these American citizens make for our nation. We appreciate everything the flyers do. And it's very important to the security of the United States of America and our leadership role in the world. I want to go to another one of these questions here. It says, at the Thunderbird show, we are seeing them fly at top speed, or do they actually slow down for us during the show? I'll just throw that out to any of the Thunderbirds that would like to answer that.
Sir, this is Captain Callahan.
Go ahead.
The F-16 can go about two times the speed of sound, about 1,400 miles an hour or so, which is pretty quick. And we keep the show at all times subsonic. We get right up to the point where we're almost supersonic, around 700 miles an hour, but don't quite go supersonic so that we can keep everybody's building and car windows intact during the show.
Yeah. Okay, here's another one. Will the Thunderbirds ever change the type of aircraft they fly? If so, what factors would drive that decision, and what command of the Air Force does the Thunder... Okay, we've got a lot of questions, so let me just do it one at a time. Will the Thunderbirds ever change the type of aircraft they fly? Obviously so with modernization, but let me let you answer that.
Yes, sir. This is Lieutenant Colonel McSpadden. We will, depending on... right now, the F-16 is the perfect airplane for us. Versatile fighter for the Air Force, does a great job for us, but it will age out sooner or later, and when that does, we'll have to make a decision. Our history has been we always like to fly frontline fighters. There was a small time period when we flew T-38s in which we didn't do that, but as to what airplane we will fly next, I'd just be speculating.
Yeah, why was it that they went to the T-38? I was looking at the dates. You did the T-38 from 74 to 81. Right after Vietnam. What's the reason for that?
It might have had to do at the time with just simple economics. They may not have had the airplanes that they could put into this kind of role, or the airplanes may have been too costly to operate in this kind of role back then. So it was most likely something like that drove the decision.
Okay. Now, Mark has a question. Go ahead, Mark.
Actually, I was stationed at Hill Air Force Base in 1981 when the Thunderbirds were doing a show, and there's a particular maneuver where the aircraft fly overhead at near Mach speed and scares this crowd. Well, that T-38 had flown overhead and scarfed up some birds in the engine and fought it out. And the pilot had a choice to continue in the aircraft or bail out. And he elected to stay in the aircraft because there was a crowd of people that if he did eject, he felt that his aircraft would take them out. So he stayed with the airplane, went over into a cow field, and crashed the airplane and died. But his choice to stay with those, stay in that aircraft to protect those people, not only showed himself as a hero, but it really honored the future the Thunderbirds from that point on.
For sure.
Well, it does drive the point home that safety is our number one priority. And, in fact, safety of the crowd is our number one priority. And so that drives everything we do. And we start thinking about that from step one in our training season, about how we will make sure that the safety of the crowd is paramount in everything we do. We've had a phenomenal safety record in the F-16, particularly, that we've flown now for going on our 21st year. In fact, our safety record is really probably about the best of any major jet aviation team around, and we're very proud of that. It has a lot to do with the safety and reliability of the airplane, and a lot to do with how we do business and how we design our maneuvers and practice them over and over again on the range with safety at the forefront of our mind.
Yeah, well said. You know, there's a question here about Thunderbirds. What command do they come under? I guess I should ask, Richard, who do you report to?
I report to my immediate boss is Brigadier General Dan Darnell, who's the wing commander at 57th Fighter Wing here at Nellis Air Force Base. We fall under the structure of the Air Warfare Center, and that's Major General Steve Wood. And from there, we go directly to General Hal Hornburg, who's the commander of Air Combat Command.
Okay, Air Warfare Center is located
at Nellis well.
At Nellis itself. Okay,
yes,
all right. I've done some work down at your Air War College, of course, at Maxwell.
At Maxwell,
this
sure.
is center. Yeah. Okay. Kenny has a question for you.
I'd like to know if the Thunderbirds have ever been used in combat.
Never have.
Never
have been used. We keep the capability to transform ourselves to a combat unit, but we've never.
And I have one other question in regards to, are we trying to hold the record of 2.5 million in 1987, or are we looking to try to break that soon?
Oh, we'd always like, you know, to see the crowd count go higher and higher, so it'd be nice to break that record somehow.
Sure, if I could add to that,
sure.
I know the Chicago crowds get to be pretty big, so in mid-August, maybe we could set that as a goal and try to break the 2.5 million. I know they get close every year, so maybe this will be the year.
This is Linda. I have a question for Colonel McSpadden.
Oh, sure, Linda.
How
nice
do you
to
feel,
meet you, by the way.
Oh, nice to meet you, too. How do you feel about if we do go to war, flying demonstrations rather than being in an operational unit?
Well, it's a mixed feeling. I mean, every member of the Thunderbirds, as you know, came from an operational unit, so that's where our heart is, and we'll be thinking very, you know, very hard about those people, and certainly they'll be in our prayers. But this is really now what I'm trained to do, and this is what I thoroughly enjoy, this mission, and it'll be very important, as you know, keeping the support strong at the home front for the folks overseas.
Right, when I was there during Desert Storm, all of us volunteered. You know, if anybody needed our specialty, we would be glad to go. But our commander at the time, he wasn't too happy. He wanted to be in the middle of the fight, you know?
Yeah.
And
we have somebody overseas that deployed to support the war effort this time. One of our communication specialists was a guy they just couldn't do without. He's over there representing us.
Well, good. And like I said, I'm proud of what you guys keep on doing. And, you know, it feels good to be a part of that. And,
great.
So thank you.
Colonel McSvadden, this is Mark Eli. While I was in the service, I was a crew chief, and I had the blessing of being able to have an incentive flight to fly in a F-16.
Oh, great.
And my pilot was Captain Buzz Masters, which is also a former Thunderbird. And there's a particular maneuver where he took me, and he flew straight up, and he pulled over, and we were pulling some negative Gs. And I was prepared at the time for some positive Gs, but when I encountered those negative Gs, needless to say, I lost it. And Captain Buzz Masters went ahead and was going to ask me how I enjoyed the maneuver, and I was so busy throwing up that I went cold mic. And then I started to go hot mic to tell him don't do it again, and all that could come out was rrr. And he thought I said okay, so he did it again. So
you got to watch those solo pilots. They're sneaky guys, I'm telling you.
Yeah, yes.
Masters was a solo pilot.
And I just was kind of curious, besides being a wimp, do pilots ever find negative Gs as uncomfortable as me?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Negative Gs are very uncomfortable. And, you know, the airplanes are stressed to 9 positive and only 3 negative. And that's for a reason. Negative Gs are kind of unnatural. They're very uncomfortable for everybody.
This is Kenny DeCamp again. I'd like to find out, how does one become a Thunderbird pilot, and as then break it down into the crew chiefs as well? Do the pilots then get to pick, or is there a test you have to take, or which way does it go?
The process to become a Thunderbird pilot is certainly very competitive. It's one that we're going through right now, the selections for the 2004 demonstration pilots. It's a 2-year job, so of the 8 pilots on the team, we'll hire 4 new guys each year. And the basic eligibility is that you can't have been in the service too long, any more than 12 years, but that you also have to be a pilot with at least 1,000 hours of fighter time. So that gets you to a baseline experience level, and which is very important for what we do. The type of flying that we do requires experienced folks that have proven themselves in a number of assignments, and certainly that lends itself to the type of competitive nature that is very much a part of the selection process on the team. Certainly folks with great records are what we look for, folks that have distinguished themselves as pilots and as officers as well in a variety of different capacities. And then as we look at the folks that we're going to bring out to potentially be team members, we'll interview them. They'll spend some time with us at a show site so they understand our job, and then they'll come back to us with analysis as well. They see where we live and work all the time, and while that's going on, while they get to know us, we get to know them and determine if we have a good match there. Certainly, I think a lot of Air Force fighter pilots could do this job, but we're around each other day in and day out, and we're certainly with each other more than we are our families. So the type of chemistry and the trust that we'll build up over the years is key. So we try to look for those kind of indicators early to bring pilots on to join the team. So it's what I'm getting at is it's a very thorough process, and it covers a variety of different categories that we look at as we bring folks on.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, one last question. Now, because you got the 50% trade out, how do you handle your stand down time to train up and integrate the new team into the old team so you can get ready to hit the road doing a show?
Well, there really is no stand down time, General. We fly our last show on a Saturday in November, and the very next Monday we begin training the new guys on board for the next show season.
Yeah, and which starts?
Which starts mid-March.
Mid-March, okay. So you got about a three-month period?
We do, and we fly. It's a very demanding, rigorous schedule for us. We fly 2 to 3 times per day every day. That's Monday through Friday, that is, in an effort to get ready to go out on the road in March.
Yeah.
And the way we do it is the guys that are on the way out the door, they will start in the back seat of the new guys, and they will learn the maneuvers up at high altitude in relatively wide formations. And then from there, we just whittle it down. We bring them in closer, add more people to the formation, drop altitudes, go closer, add more people, drop altitudes, until finally we get down to where we want to be.
Yeah. That must be very tense and rigorous, obviously, but without the appropriate training and rehearsals, obviously you can't get to the perfection that you have to meet. So
exactly.
That's something that, you know, when you're watching a demonstration, I guess a lot of people don't think about that so much, but, you know, it's so much preparation.
Well, we take a lot of pride in that, though. You know, we get a question frequently, particularly for the Diamond. People will, and that's the formation where the four airplanes are all flying together, and they will ask us, well, how do you program your computers to, you know, fly so closely to each other? People think that it's computerized, you know, which is really a tribute to the Wingman and the Diamond, that they can fly that so smooth and so stable.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, again, we have to pull pitch, but I just want to tell you thank you very much for being with us tonight. Great show, and it's because of all of you. Well, we thank you again.
Well, sir, we thank you for having us. Enjoyed doing it.
And good luck to you, and we'll be watching for you here in Illinois.
Best of luck to you, sir. It's an honor to talk with you.
Thanks, sir.
This has been the Veterans Radio Hour. Stay with us. We'll be coming back to you next week, every Sunday, veteransradiohour.com, 9 p.m. Central. Want to give a great big thanks to Fred Cutchins, our announcer, for always being here during our web programming, and the whole staff of Veterans Radio Hour here at the Veterans Radio Center. This is Kenny DeCamp saying over and out tonight, and see you next week when we do our special program on the Philippine American soldier. And good night, all.